National Weather Service. Winter storm warning today. Cloudy, windy, and snowy. Maybe 6 to 10 inches of snow. A high of 33. Northeast winds up to 35 miles per hour. Right now it is windy. Wind is from the northeast at 20, gusting to 31. 33 degrees Kenosha, 32 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to begin today's program with a newcomer to the Morning Show, but I have a feeling that this is not the last time we will be talking with Vijay Pandian. And Vijay Pandian is a horticulture educator for the Kenosha County UW Extension. And over my many years here at WGTD, we've had a number of different people from UW Extension as part of this program, and Vijay Pandian is just the latest, and we'll be finding out about some of the things that he does there, and in particular about an exciting conference that is coming up in a few weeks, I believe, and he'll also share, before we're done, a little bit of advice in terms of those of us with gardens to start thinking about what to do and to make plans for the coming spring and summer, which will be upon us before we know it. So, Vijay Pandian, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Good morning, Greg. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here, and happy to make your acquaintance. I'm glad you reached out to us and expressed your interest in being part of the Morning Show. Since it is your first visit, let's find out a little bit about you, about where you come from, and sort of the professional and personal path that took you ultimately to what you're doing right now with UW Extension.
Thank you, Greg. I'm originally from India. I did my graduation bachelor's degree in India in the field of horticulture. Hmm. My dad was a great Rosarian, and that really inspired me, actually, to choose a spot in horticulture. So back in those days, you know, my dad had a beautiful collection of various varieties of roses. And, you know, that he did all kind of grafting techniques back in the time. And so that really inspired me, you know, to get into the path of, you know, horticulture. Did my graduation at Michigan State University back in 2005. And after I graduated, and my advisor was an extension specialist. His name was Bernie Zanstra, and he's a vegetable crop specialist. And so he took me around, actually, to various counties in Michigan, doing a lot of, you know, field research and providing outreach education for farmers. And that's really inspired me, actually, to also be an extension educator, get to know about the farmers and dealing with the issues the farming communities are facing through in Michigan. And also doing all kind of, you know, on-site, you know, demonstration trials to get to know what the practical solutions to resolve all the farming issues. And then an opportunity came at University of Wisconsin in the field of extension and applied, and I got the job. And in fact, my first posting was in way up in northern Wisconsin in Bayfield and Ashland County as an Ashland, as an agriculture agent. And it was a total different experience for me living up there. But I had a great experience working with the fruit growers in Bayfield counties. Hmm. And got to know, I learned a lot about fruit production there. And I was able to do some outreach education programs working with the fruit communities in Bayfield County. And then I got down to Green Bay, and I spent majority of my career life, about 14 years in Green Bay as a horticulture extension educator. And I enjoyed the moment in Green Bay. Met a lot of different master gardener volunteers, trained a lot of master gardener volunteers, worked with the green industries in Green Bay area, and worked on several horticultural research projects in Green Bay. So it was a very eye-opening in my career life in the field of horticulture, where it really learned me to know more about from A to Z in horticulture.
When is it that you then took the position with Kenosha County?
So then I got transferred 3 years ago, 6 months before the COVID hit. So my appointment is both for Kenosha, Racine, and 10% of my time in Milwaukee as well, too. So in this three-county area, I tend to provide plant health advising program, working with the master gardeners. So I integrated the three county areas, plant health advising program, and providing information and services where any gardeners have any issues related to pest diseases or even general gardening information. We tend to provide those things through our master gardener volunteers. And I also work closely with the green industry folks, our landscape contractors, lawn service providers, nursery growers. We tend to host a lot of outreach education program with them. And I'm also getting involved in doing research trials at Kenosha County Center. So recently, we have developed an urban tree demonstration trial program. So with the climate change and all these things happening up, how it's going to affect our urban trees, what trees are better suited to withstand all this fluctuating climate, And so we are doing a test trials at the Kenosha County Center. We have about 94 trees right now with the 44 genus. So we are testing, which trees can withstand all the drought. That's very interesting things going on at the Kenosha County Center as well.
So that would be a way to figure out what kind of trees would be wisest for us to plant, because they're the trees that are going to be more likely to flourish.
Absolutely. Because, as you all see, every year the weather seems to be unpredictable, and that's going to be happening up, pretty soon. There are some various computer-focused models that shows that beginning in 2040, we're going to face, multiple days where the temperature is going to be about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And many of the tree species cannot handle, more than 30 to 45 days of 90-degree weather. So we want to see actually what tree species can withstand such kind of, high temperature and also tolerant to drought as well, too. So we need to start building that right now so we can able to better have some tree canopy when it get to that stage.
Right.
So that's one of my focus. The second thing we are focusing on, trying to encourage homeowners to consume more fresh berries. So many of the fruit berries are rich in antioxidants. So from blueberries, aronia berries, elderberries, currants, gooseberries, all these different berries. People have very well known about strawberries and raspberries and blueberries. How else people know about other berries? So we want to showcase them, hey, there are more berries which can be easily adapted in your landscape. So we are doing a demonstration trial as well to experimenting with different type of berries, including honeyberries, which is also called Hascap, and we are testing different varieties of these honeyberries. And in fact, these berries are very tolerant to our alkaline soil compared to blueberries, which is very finicky about the soil pH. And we are experimenting those type of unique berries in our landscape right up here.
So you're trying to determine some of these other types of berries, which ones can very likely do well here, and then encouraging homeowners, home gardeners to incorporate that into what they're planting.
Absolutely. So which can tolerate our soil conditions, which is relatively low maintenance. Those are the unique characteristics and features that we are looking for in selecting a berry crop that can grow easily well in our landscape.
Fascinating. We're speaking with Vijay Pandian, who is horticulture educator with the Kenosha County UW Extension. He's been there for several years. You mentioned that you were born and raised in India, and with a father who raised roses in a very serious way, it sounds like. Did you come to the United States for your education specifically because of any particular thing? I mean, does it make sense for someone interested in this to come to the United States to study it? Or was it that you were interested in learning about it in a different way than would have been possible in India?
So I came to the United States to pursue my higher education. And back in the time in India, the field of horticulture is very naive, I would say, in a sense. There is not much opportunity to pursue, advances in that horticulture field. So I was exploring options, where I can able to pursue my degree, learn about some of the experience and skills in the field of horticulture and the avenues that's going to be opening up, especially in the field of genetics. That really inspired me to, pursue my graduate degree program in the United States. But life took me a different turn as I started pursuing in my graduate school with Bernie Zanstra, that applied science, finds me more thrilling as I start engaging with my advisor, Bernie Zanstra, back in the time, interacting with various farming communities. We make a difference. Sometimes, what you learn in the lab sometimes could be very different what is outside the lab.
In real life.
The practical applications, it really matters a lot rather than being stuck in the four walls in the lab.
Right.
So that really, changed my aspect, the way of how I think looks, So, yes.
I can well imagine. Do you feel like where you come from gives you certain insights that you might not otherwise have? That is, to grow up in one very different part of the world where, much of this is probably done in very, very different ways, and now you are here in the United States, do you feel like you bring some of that, speaking of real-life application, do you bring some of that to the work that you do, or are the landscapes so different from one another that they're almost two different disciplines?
That's a very good question. My mother used to kid me. Vijay now use experience in a two extreme part of the world because since growing up in India, in southern part of India, the temperature during in the summertime gets way more than 100 degrees, 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It's so hot and humid. Mm. So I used to live in Bayfield, and the temperature plunges down to minus 20 degrees
right,
and stuff like that.
Exactly.
And
you've seen it all.
So I've seen both, in the tropical world, growing up with mangoes and bananas, the tropical fruit. And I also seen, growing up, in my career life in growing pears and apples and cherries and blueberries, So it is a blessing for me that as a horticulturist, I was able to have an experience growing with the tropical fruits and vegetables and learning about some of the tropical landscape. At the same time, I was very blessed to also learn about the temperate crops, So that makes me more fulfilling in my career life that, back in the time in India, when I was learning my undergraduate program, we used to learn about apples and pears and books. But in reality, now I was able to experience all
those
things.
You could actually see an apple, right?
And I can able to grow them and
right.
Experience the fun of growing all those temperate crops. So that's something, is very cherishing to me.
Mm.
And at the same time, it also, I was able to bring some of those knowledge that I able to gain back in India back here as well, too. in terms of grafting techniques. So how do you graft different type of, like, whip grafting, whip and tongue grafting, bridge grafting? Those type of grafting skills are very common in when you're propagating tropical fruits. And now they have been adapted very well in grafting apples and pears. So I was able to bring those skill sets also during in my career as well here. And also even for grafting roses, it was very thrilling for me actually to do all kind of tea budding grafting as well as, yard layering techniques and, all those, grafting techniques as well can be employed in many ornamental plants in here. So those kind of skills and knowledge I was able to bring in. And at the same time, many of our houseplants are more of a tropical in nature. So, mm-hmm. And I've seen actually most of these houseplants growing as a small, like a big shrub or like a tall tree back in India. Mm. And now trying to adapt those things as a houseplant, and trying to figure out what is a requirement to be as a houseplant, I was able to share those information and knowledge as well too. So, so it's fun, to enjoy both parts of those, plant communities, so that makes my life more thrilling.
I like that. Yeah, you've experienced a lot, seen a lot, and can bring all of that to bear in what you do now. I think that's great. I know that one of the reasons you reached out to me was because of a big event that is coming up with Kenosha County UW Extension, some kind of a conference. Tell us when that is and what it is.
Yes. On March 18th this year, we are hosting Spring into Gardening Conference. And this conference is open to any gardeners, or even if you don't have a gardening experience, you can join this conference as well too. So we have some excellent speakers who's going to talk about, landscaping and gardening. We have Melinda Myers, one of the very well-known, renowned speaker. She's going to talk about, how do you renovate your landscape, which is one of the common things, because right now, many landscape plans, if you have been outgrown yourself, or if you want to change it to fit to your budget thing, then probably, this will be a great talk to learn from her. How do you renovate your landscape that's going to fit to your budget? And we're also going to have another speaker, Diana Blasek. She's actually in charge for All American Selection Program. And she's also going to talk about some of the All American Selection vegetable crop winners, in our landscape as well. And like I said, this conference is open to anyone. And you can go online at go.wisc.edu, spring into gardening. Or just Google up Spring into the Gardening, and it'll pop on. And just sign up for the program. It's on Saturday, on March 18th. All our master gardeners are working towards, hosting this conference. So we welcome everyone to join this
program.
And
it's in person?
It's in person. It's going to be hosted in the campus center. Hmm. And, it's a one-day conference, and the lunch is also going to be provided.
Very good. So even though we are talking in the middle of February, and of course it's a very warm day today, nevertheless, I think especially those of us who are not particularly serious about gardening would never think that February is a time to be thinking about much of this. And of course, you want to correct us of that mistake. And in fact, now is the time to be thinking and planning, correct?
Absolutely. Talk about climate change. Mm-hmm. We are witnessing all this kind of unpredictable weather right mm-hmm. now. Who would have thought actually in February it's going to rain?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that
it'd
is
be 52 degrees.
Yes. And with the temperature averaging about 40 degrees, and we don't have much snow in the ground. And so when you do have this kind of warmer temperature, which is unusually warmer in the month of February, now is a time you need to start thinking about pruning. So if you do have, apple trees or pear trees or even ornamental trees, especially oak trees, now is a time to prune them. So pruning helps the trees to grow more vigorously and more healthy. It allows better light penetration into the crown. So if you have any dead, diseased, broken branches, now is the time to trim those things off. So select a day which is nice and sunny, but the temperature is above freezing degree. So you can start thinking about pruning those trees, especially oak trees. Oak should not be pruned during the growing season, especially from April to June, July, because of the threat of oak wilt disease. So, you know, due to that reason, now, you know, you need to prune them during the middle of the winter time. So I would strongly encourage, you know, if you do have oak trees, prune them right now. At the same time, apple trees can also be pruned right now. So get out, use your pruning tools, and start thinking about pruning. We do have wonderful extension publications and fact sheets, you know, that talks about pruning. Just type in pruning UW extension. It brings you all those information. Or you can join our pruning session on April 1st at Kenosha County Center. So I'll be doing a pruning demonstration session for apples, ornamental trees, and shrub. And this session is free for anyone. All you have to do is to register. So just go to Kenosha County Extension, and you will find our information on pruning session. And please sign up for that.
That's a really good thing to offer, because I know for a lot of us, it's a scary thing. We're afraid that we're going to do something that will cause damage to the tree or shrub in question. And knowing how to do it well, is really important for people's confidence and peace of mind.
Absolutely. You know, yeah, it could be scary, but I think once you know the science and the art behind to it, then probably, you know, you can able to prune any trees and shrubs. So we'll be teaching all those things in the upcoming pruning session on April 1st.
Fantastic. Remind our listeners once again about this other event, which is coming sooner than that on March 18th, and what they should do if they want to be part of it.
So on March 18th, you know, we are hosting the Spring to the Gardening Conference at the Kemper Center. So Google up Spring to the Gardening, and you can sign up for the session. So it's a one-day conference, and the total charge will be $50, including lunch. We have a great speakers, Melinda Moyer, Diana Blasix. They're going to talk about, you know, how do you renovate your landscape, and also talking about some All-American Selections winners. And we're also going to have a special sessions on plants that can do very well in problematic areas as well, too, and how the gardening is going to improve your health-wise as well. So we have all these kind of interesting topics for this upcoming gardening conference. So please come and join us for the conference.
Very good. Vijay Pandian from the Kenosha County UW Extension. It's great to make your acquaintance face-to-face, and I hope that we can have you on the morning show again to have more conversations about the lawn and garden.
Thank you, Greg, for inviting me. Looking forward to seeing you again.
Very good. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. We explore today the fascinating and sometimes very challenging world of phobias, and specifically what occurs when someone is assailed with very serious phobias which affect nearly every detail of their daily lives. I'm speaking today with Alan Shawn, who is already a well-known writer. You perhaps have seen his work in Atlantic Monthly. He's written an interesting book about composer Alan Schoenberg, and his newest book is called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life, in which he talks about the array of phobias which have affected his life for many years, including especially serious agoraphobia and claustrophobia and so on. And he traces some of the possible reasons why his life is one that is lived with the harsh realities of all these phobias and the ways in which he has managed to cope with them and carve out for himself a very successful and happy life. And we speak with him for the next few minutes about all of this. Again, the book called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. And Alan Shaun, we welcome you to the morning show.
Very nice to talk with you, Greg.
Looking forward to this very, very much. So you are afraid of many different things. And when we sort of make a list of them, it's really kind of astonishing to realize how much of a full life you've been able to live, despite the fact that you have a terrible fear of heights and water and enclosed spaces and crowds and so on. In a nutshell, how have you managed to do that?
Well, I should say, first of all, that when I talk to other people with these types of problems, they generally unpack a pretty full suitcase of things that they don't like, just as I do. And it turns out that an awful lot of people suffer from not just a couple of specific things that they don't like, but kind of a whole constellation of things that circumscribes their behavior. But yes, like many people, I have tried to carve out a life that consists of the things that I don't need to avoid and that I don't dread. I teach. I'm a composer first and foremost, a pianist. I teach at Bennington College. I teach music. And I also have started to write in midlife. I started to actually write. I first wrote the book on Arnold Schoenberg, and now I've written this book about really a subject that I wish I could avoid, but which turned out to be so fascinating that I did end up with quite a bit to say about it, as you know.
Right. When you are experiencing, I don't know if we want to call it an attack or what,
sure.
An attack of agoraphobia or one of these other phobias, for instance, I mean, you have great difficulty, for instance, if you have to drive over a bridge or in a tunnel.
Yes.
You cannot ride on a subway.
Right.
When you have these attacks, is there something tangible that you are afraid will happen to you, or is it more of a kind of an unnamed and an unspecific sort of dread which you experience?
Well, people tend to think of these types of reactions as being all in your mind. But to the poor sufferer, it's much more like an allergy. You find that every time you go through a tunnel, you have a whole series of physical symptoms, culminating in a lot of thoughts of dread, but it doesn't start by, you know, in a rational way with a thought such as the tunnel's going to cave in on me. It's really much more like a response that you'd see in a cat or a dog or a horse. You know, you want to run, you want to flee. It's the famous fight or flight symptom.
Mm. Well, and you, I know, talk in the book about some of the very real physical symptoms.
Yes.
Which you experience as well. Tell our listeners about the most acute of them.
Well, I think our listeners all know these symptoms, but maybe most people experience them when there's really some danger occurring and they need to respond to it. Rapid heartbeat, shortness of breath, maybe a tightening in the chest or even chest pains, perspiring, tingling sensations, to name just a few. And then, of course, the mental experience of being confused and disoriented and kind of frantic, all of which is really physiological in origin. Although, when it's happening to you, you ascribe it to, well, really one of two things. You think that you're physically in great danger or mentally in great danger.
Hmm.
In fact, what's happening is that your body is responding exactly as it should in a dangerous situation, but at the wrong time.
Hmm. I think it's especially interesting that you have a terror for closed-in places.
Yes.
And a fear of wide-open spaces, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the wide-open spaces reaction is something that only really I noticed when I started to write the book. A lot of these things are so instinctive that I just think of them as part of the world itself, part of life. And I realized, you know, even writing the book, how all of this added up into one giant syndrome that's really a very, very inconvenient, to put it mildly.
Hmm. Part of your book is an effort for you to maybe untangle some of the possible reasons behind your phobias, and specifically some of the ways in which you're challenging childhood in a child challenging home might have at least something to do with why you live with these serious phobias. Yes. I want you to tell our listeners about the interesting story you tell of your mother and what she would be like in the car when your family would be going someplace. This is a really interesting insight into her and maybe into some of her demons.
That's interesting that you focus on her, because, of course, in my childhood, my father was much more the person who we all thought of as suffering from anxiety and phobias. But our mother was very much a part of that, because she lived exactly the same way he did. But in a way, her problems were concealed behind his, which were more obvious. And after his death, she didn't really live particularly differently. And she too had an incredible fear of being in an unknown place and not knowing where she was, being lost. And when we would travel to Boston or sometimes through New Jersey, she would always have a map, and she would always be looking at every point along the way. But even going to Lincoln Center from 96th Street and 5th Avenue, she would tell the taxi driver exactly what route to take, where to turn, and she would dole it out rather slowly, bit by bit.
And politely, you tell us.
Very politely. She was both my parents were amazingly courteous and gentle people, but there was a firm grip there, even on a small journey, as if there were all kinds of dangers out there that you had to be wary of.
Sure. So she would say, the driver would take a certain turn, as she requested, thank you. Now,
yes.
At the next corner, you will turn right. Thank you, and then on to the next.
Absolutely correct.
Hmm. And, of course, what I suppose might be at the heart of some of your life of fear, if we should call it that, is that if you saw in her this overwhelming need and desire for utter control, then stepping into any kind of situation which is clearly just beyond your control would be a truly frightening thing.
Yes, I mean, we're talking about how basic, you know, instincts can be molded by your upbringing and by your own habits. I mean, of course, we start with our genetic makeup, and I'm sure that in my family tree there's a strong genetic tendency towards anxiety. But then, you know, how you're brought up is terribly important, and you're completely right that having both parents who were monitoring their every move so carefully and not terribly spontaneous in the outer world. You know, they were quite spontaneous and adventurous intellectually, but in the outer world, not. Of course, a lot of that rubbed off on me. But then, you know, you can move beyond your upbringing in so many ways. So the mystery is, you know, why one member of a family becomes very much like his parents, you know, in terms of problems such as, let's say, drinking or you know, anger or other kinds of difficulties people have, and another family member is free of them.
Hmm. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
I wonder, in this life filled with so many phobias, is there a strong temptation for you to confront those things so feared in the hopes that maybe something has happened and maybe you're not going to be afraid of riding the subway, or you're not going to be afraid to go over a bridge or through a tunnel? Or at some point, do you know without even attempting to encounter those things that such a thing remains impossible? And is it possible to really know that?
Right. That's a difficult question. You'd hope that such things might just evaporate on their own. I think the only way to get over these types of habits of body and mind, really, is to have positive experiences doing those things, and to demystify them and retrain, really, your very brain to respond differently to those experiences. So I've never stopped pushing myself, although, you know, everybody who knows me wishes I pushed myself more. But, of course, I keep trying all kinds of things in an effort not to discover that I no longer have the responses, because they're so ingrained, but to bit by bit chip away at the habits. I'm really talking about habits that are ingrained in, you know, in the brain itself, to create new pathways in the brain, which sounds, you know, fanciful, except that's exactly what really the experts in the field recommend.
Hmm. You are, as you mentioned, a music faculty member. I should have certainly mentioned that. I happen to be a music professor myself.
No kidding.
Yeah, right. And you are a composer.
Yes.
And of course, one of the things that I'm sure has been especially painful or frustrating for you is the fact that it is tremendously difficult for you to be, for instance, at public concerts, even those where your own music is being performed. And
yeah,
it's hard to think of a more unfortunate scenario than someone who creates music for just such occasions which either you cannot attend yourself or can only do so with sort of gritted teeth and grim determination. Has that become any easier over the years?
Well, I have, you know, ways of turning up at places that are, you know, highly enjoyable, and then there are situations that I simply can't bear. I mean, if I'm, you know, if I had a piece played at Lincoln Center and I could sit on the aisle, there's no problem with that for me. I have a joyful experience at such occasions. But if I have to take a plane or if I have to take an elevator to, you know, to even the 10th floor, the very same experience would be very difficult for me. And even driving, as you suggested earlier, you know, a few hours to a place I haven't been before to hear my own music, I would have to practice the drive as if, you know, as if there's something really difficult for me in the drive itself, and in finding my way there, which is even to me astonishing, but it's the truth.
Hmm. I don't have the book in front of me, unfortunately, and I'm trying to remember this for
yes.
certain. I believe you are or have been married.
Oh, yes.
And have a family. That part, for some reason, was a little bit vague in my mind. And
right, because I don't really bring my personal life into the book much. I deliberately avoid.
Right. I mean, you talk about how in a sense, you wanted this to be both a personal and impersonal book.
Yes.
And I thought it was for a very laudable reason, because in a sense, you don't want people so caught up in some of the specific personal details of your own life that they can't sort of see themselves or use the book to help themselves with their own lives and their own particular situations.
Right. That's absolutely right. I mean, I was married for many years, and I was divorced, and I'm now remarried. I have two children, and I'm actually, believe it or not, expecting a third child in July, even though I'm about to turn 60.
Wow.
So, you know, my life is very eventful on the family plane.
Right.
I didn't want the book to be a memoir in the traditional sense. It's about 50% memoir. But I thought there were, because some of the members of my family are quite well known, I thought that it could easily be perceived as basically a book even of gossip. And I wanted it to be about personality and the origins of the many quirks we all have. Mine are, you know, really regrettable and pretty serious, but I think everybody has a personality and has sides of themselves that are mystifying to them. I would almost say that 99% of what we do as we go through our day is mystifying to us.
Hmm.
And I was trying to go deeper into that rather than to just talk about people who are well known. So actually, people reading the book don't even notice that I do not use names in my book. For the most part, except for my sister. She has a name, and that was for a very specific reason.
This is a sister who is institutionalized?
She is. She's autistic and mentally retarded and suffers from schizoaffective disorder. And she is my twin. And the story of my sister sort of surfaces in the book as really equal in importance to my own story, and a big part of maybe the pain and difficulty behind my current problems. And to be honest, talking about mystification, that surprised me. As I was writing the book, I found that emerged.
You mean your deep feelings about her and her
yes.
being institutionalized, and yes. that occurred at the age of 8.
Yes.
So this is a sad circumstance with which you have lived for many, many years.
For many years, and of course, certainly highlights the issue of traveling in a very different way than one might at first expect.
We have just passed the 20-minute mark, but if you would permit me,
yes.
I would love to just have a brief word from you, if you have the time, to just tell us, if you are comfortable, just a little bit about what it has been like to create your own family within the framework of a life that is riddled with these phobias. I guess what I'm curious about more than anything is if you have managed to do that more easily than maybe you would have anticipated at the outset. I mean, what has that experience been like for you?
Well, I've tried to be more honest with my children than my parents were with me about these things. It's a different time, and there's a lot of candor in the air these days that was not there in the 1950s when I was growing up. So I've tried to be honest with them about the difficulties I have, and I've, encouraged them to be adventurous in many ways that I have not been, and to try to take from me whatever my good points are. Also, my two children, who are now fairly grown up, 19 and 23, their mother is a world traveler and completely different type of personality, so that's benefited them wonderfully. I mean, being a parent is participating in life, you know, and in evolution, you know, I recommend it. I recommend it to everyone, and I don't think that having these types of handicaps and other kinds, for that matter, should make people there think they're not possibly competent parents. I think everyone has their difficulties, and if you can bring up your children with some honesty about that, and that people are not, as depicted in the you know, glossy magazines, and are in fact very complicated and often, almost always flawed, I think you can bring up, you know, children who are able to face their own lives.
Sure. Well, and I suppose, I mean, if I'm sure this impacted family life in many ways. I mean, you probably couldn't, assuming your children were musicians, it was probably difficult, if not impossible, for you to attend most or many of their functions, for instance. But for them to have to come to grips with that and understand your own weaknesses or the difficulties with which you were contending,
right,
that's probably
right.
Good for any young person to be sort of wrenched out of their own desires and think about someone else and their struggles, even if it's your own father.
Right. You've spoken truthfully. I mean, obviously, there's that tug of war between difficulties I have and the needs of others, and tug of war between a sense that this is a character flaw and something more, you know, like a medical disability. And, you know, that's just the way it is.
The book again is called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. It's published by Viking, and a fascinating book, start to finish. And its author, Alan Shawn. Alan Shawn, I'm so glad that you have written this book, and I'm sure it will be of tremendous help to anyone who lives with this reality, and I think will be tremendously interesting even to those who thankfully are not living with this sort of reality in their lives. We all have a lot to learn from your very interesting story, and I thank you today for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your interesting book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg, and to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be previewing for you a really fascinating documentary that will air Monday night on the PBS series American Experience. It is about the development of the board game Monopoly. It's a surprisingly complicated and fascinating story, which we'll hear explored as we preview that with Sam Winston, who is the writer and director of this marvelous film. Next week on The Morning Show, we're going to be busy with a lot of interesting things, including a conversation with one of the members of a terrific vocal jazz group called New York Voices. If you're familiar with Manhattan Transfer, New York Voices is a similar sort of group and a group of comparable excellence. They're going to be performing at Carthage College Thursday evening next week, so a week from tonight. Also, from Marvel Comics, Mackenzie Lee talks about her most recent novel. On Tuesday, we're hoping to preview the upcoming production of the classic play Raisin in the Sun by the Lakeside Players in Kenosha. And Wednesday's morning show should include a preview of a powerful play called The Tin Woman, about to open at the Racine Theater Guild. An interesting story of a woman who has received a heart transplant and is struggling with feelings of guilt. And a week from today, next Thursday, February 23rd, Herschel Kruger and guest director Samantha Martinson will talk about the next play that will be opening at Carthage College. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.